Did I hear somebody on the news just a few moments ago mention to the fact that his opponent was offering to the people of the United States a pie in the sky? Did I hear that, or was I hearing wrong again, as I've often heard wrong in all of the 10,000 years that I've existed on this planet? In fact, I'm coming to the conclusion that I'm always hearing wrong. And it's just a pie in the sky. I wish somebody would offer just once, come out and honestly say, I'm offering pie in the sky. And what is pie in the sky? I would love to have some. Where do you go to get that? Do they sell that at Nenix or Schraft's? Or where do you get pie in the sky? I mean, what kind of pie is that? You know, there's some pies I don't buy. Other pies I'll go for. But I guess, though, the pie in the sky syndrome is always going to be with us. And I suppose also the concomitant syndrome is the belief and the desire for pie in the sky will always be with us. Whatever pie in the sky is, that is. Whatever. Pie in the sky, that is. Whatever. You know, speaking of pie in the sky, I got a terrible masochistic strain running through me, but for the last 3 or 4 days, for some reason or other, I've always been very close to a radio. I rarely do this unless there's some very, very strong extenuating circumstances, but I've been very close to a radio lately, and I hear endless numbers of people talking on the radio, all trying to explain how it can all be improved. Endless numbers of people. And they range all the way from guys who are in charge of calories to guys who are in charge of your soul. And an occasional politician. Guys that make movies. Guys that write books. Guys that do acts at the bitter end. Every kind of guy in the world. Chicks, all kinds of people there are coming on day and night. I guess never in the history of mankind, I would be willing to bet, I just can't imagine it being any worse than this in the Byzantine period, that at any time in the history of mankind there have been more people trying to figure out what's wrong and how to fix it. And it just rises a gigantic crescendo. And I'm sure that there must have been guys standing around in the, maybe 2,000 years before Christ, maybe 3,000-4,000 years ago in Egypt, arguing about whether or not Ra really is an efficacious god, or whether Ra is a kindly, beneficent god, or whether there is even a Ra after all. And they're arguing, standing around there in front of the pyramids, and one guy's belting the other, and the other. Okay, there must have been endless, endless miles of papyrus written about the great philosophical arguments of the period. Certainly, they've even deciphered a few. They keep being washed up on the shore in jugs and one thing and another. It's and it's going on and on. And yet, right here in our own backyard, so to speak, another one of the great blisters on the hide of mankind is about to burst. There is nothing more telltale, I believe, than a gigantic, great jubilee or celebration when man decides to have one, that is more telltale about what it really is like. These jubilees have broken out from time to time throughout history. Oh, yes. So Victoria had one. Queen Victoria had a famous jubilee. And there was a couple of them. There was one in Chicago. There have been jubilees all throughout the ages. And, in fact, the jubilee, that the very first jubilees, have you ever seen pictures of the medieval jubilees when the fair would be held, the yearly fair? And they'd get together and they'd have all kinds of things. Oh, it has always proven to be one of the high spots of the time. And the New York World's Fair bids fair to tell us more about ourselves than Robert Moses would ever dare to hope. In fact, the current hassle about modern art says a great deal about the intellectual attitudes of the World's Fair. The current World's Fair, it's a very interesting World's Fair we're developing here. And I was reading on the front page of the Times, I guess it was, where there was a discussion that there are more tickets already sold for the World's Fair than any other box office event in the history of the United States. They're talking about advance tickets. They sold something like $34 million worth of advance. Boy, the women's clubs up in Westchester must be buying them up even more than the newest Richard Rogers turkey, you know? They must be swinging up there. And it's when it was announced, Mr. Moses smiled slightly. with a great satisfaction. Of course, the object of a World's Fair, as we all know, is to sell tickets. And certainly this one has already achieved its object. And the more I hear about it, the more I'm fascinated. I'm convinced that I will not be able to stay away from this thing. All summer I'll be out there with my eyeballs bugging, because it will be, you'll have to be able to explain it to people 1,000 years from now, whenever it'll be. I've been fortunate, I think, in that I have been able to attend some of the greater fiascos in the New York area in the past 8 or 9 years. I'll never forget the Mike Todd party. No, I was on hand. I did the only play-by-play broadcast out of Madison Square Garden. You know, the television cameras, if you recall that fiasco. The television cameras picked up that incredible show they had where they marched around with the commercials for Nathan's hot dogs and all kinds of stuff, and Fernandel kept falling off the donkey, and poor old the English actor was hanging on the side of an elephant there. I can still see him, and his glasses were falling off, and I thought we were going to see a real show there. It had all the elements of a genuine Roman circus. I mean, guys were being thrown to the elephants and everything. What's his name? Oh, come on, that old English actor. Funny old actor, good actor. Sir Cedric Hardwick, that's it. Sir Cedric Hardwick, and he came charging down the home course there, falling off that pink elephant, his pith helmet awry. Oh, it was wild. Did you see it? His glasses falling. You were out there, weren't you? His glasses falling, and the elephant was going, ooh, and a dog kept running around barking at the elephants, and Fernandel, who speaks very little English, obviously could not read the signs that were plugging Nathan's hot dogs and Mayflower donuts. And he was plugging a picture which never came into being, Don Quixote. And and strangely enough, he was dressed as Don Quixote, talking about pursuing windmills. Well, I'm out there watching this whole scene, and after the television went off is when the show started. They lowered Liz Taylor from a boom into a gigantic pink cake. She was wearing one of her especially tight dresses, and she was in a very tight period. She was about 20 pounds overweight, and she was wearing a dress from last season, so you could hear it thrumming like canvas in the wind, you know, on a four-mast, boing. I was expecting the show really to start, you know. And with that, she started to throw large chunks of pink cake down to the assemblage there, and within 30 seconds, it degenerated into something that rivaled anything that they ever had on the Colosseum in Rome. I mean, all we needed, guys with black jackets were coming off of 8th Avenue. You know, it says 8th Avenue, hot shots on the back, and we're stealing outboard motors and running away with the airplane. And oh, it was a great moment. I'll never forget the sight of Ben Grauer walking around with a dazed look on his face with 17 balloons in his hand and a little plastic Japanese beanie. And he's walking around in the shape of Mike Todd, and he's walking around there. And he was about to take this home with him when suddenly out of the crowd zipped a matron trailing diamonds and rubies, and she grabbed that plastic blimp right out of poor old Ben Grauer's hands and scooted off into the crowd. Oh, boy. And so, you know, I've seen quite a few things in my time, and I don't intend to miss this. I wonder if any of you remember that broadcast. You know, I never heard anybody talk about that broadcast. What do you mean bad? You mean the party was bad or the broadcast? Oh, the broadcast was bad. Thank you. I see I've got a fan sitting in there. Why? Was it a bad pickup, or was I bad? The what? What do you mean the show? We weren't there to broadcast a show, you idiot. I was there to talk about a social phenomenon. I didn't do it. Is that it? Okay. Fine. Well, of course, you never should ask an engineer, you know. They think test patterns come over good. But nevertheless, the show was interesting. Whether you like it or not, Dad, he's got a very strong union in 10 ears. But nevertheless, the incident out there, I thought, was worthy of reporting, even if I wasn't capable of it. We should have had Walter Cronkite, right? No, who? Why? Oh, you mean Studio X was better? Oh, boy. I can see you're interested in our time. I suppose you say that we should erase all bad news out of the news. All right, you're off the list. Okay, he says yeah, so that's that. I should learn. I learned that years ago. But nevertheless, the broadcast to me was, I was delighted to be there because it was so bad. That was what made it good. Now, the World's Fair, I think, is working its way up to something like that with the business of the modern art. Did you read in the, there was an ad, I don't know where it came from. I have it here. You'll love Walt Disney's magic touch at General Electric Progress Land. Now, I'm getting the idea that Walt Disney must have built this whole fair, did he? He built the Ford exhibit, he built General Electric. What else has he, what did he leave out there? He did not build Long Island. I think that was there before he came around. But Walt Disney and Progress Land, I think this is very significant that we get a Mickey Mouse expert to explain Progress to us. Speaking of Mickey Mouse, this is WOR AM at FM New York. We'll be here until 5850, or until my engineer can get me off as quickly as possible. This show causes him to itch. But nevertheless, I do believe that the selection of Walt Disney as the creator of the World's Fair was more than a passing coincidence. And I do believe also that World's Fairs, in that way, will say a great deal more about our time than they are intended to. In other words, the fair is intended to applaud ourselves. It's intended to applaud the 20th century, I presume. What do they call it? They just call it the World's Fair. It doesn't have any name like a Century of Progress or anything like that, does it? Just the World's Fair. Well, I presume it's meant to applaud us and our achievements. That is mankind. Whether or not it does is, of course, axiomatic. But then to follow this a little closely, why Walt Disney to applaud mankind? I guess because he operates in the world of Disneyland itself, of course, is an unreal world. It's a world that people want to have, except that, of course, it doesn't exist. It's a kind of paradise. I think one of the reasons why people are drawn to Disneyland, I'm talking about the original Disneyland, is that Disneyland is in a sense, it is a fantasy of paradise. It is a fantasy where even the animals are kind of cute. A Kodiak bear roars, but you don't feel any sense of fear. When the great prehistoric creatures growl in the undergrowth, they look kind of cute. They look vaguely like Clarabelle Cow. The Tyrannosaurus Rex has just the slight overtones of, say, Goofy. There's a little element in there of Horace Horse Collar. And it kind of makes everything nice and friendly, and there is no menace whatsoever in it. Now, I suspect that most people in the world today, particularly people who are involved in a great technological civilization, do feel a vague sense of menace about the future and about the technical world that we live in. Now, whether or not they want to concede this, I think most people do feel a vague sense of lostness, a little menace, you know, the traffic, everything is too big, the giant buildings and the enormous machines, the factories and the fantastic corporations, until finally you have very little voice in almost anything. So if you could make a representation of that world in Horace Horse Collar terms, somehow it would lose a little of its menace. It would be somehow a little friendlier, you know, a little nicer. It'd be more fun. I wonder how a guy feels who has just been laid off due to automation going through General Electric's Progress Land. I suspect he'll have a good time. I really do. And because, you know, all the machines are all kind of baby blue colored and pink and yellow and soft and warm and nice. And it will give him a warm feeling. A warm feeling, of course, that is not at all related to the fact he just lost his job. You know, speaking of World's Fairs, I remember one of the really most colorful exhibits and telling, meaningful exhibits, I suspect, that I can recall from the World's Fair that I saw when I was a kid. Now, it is... I submit that many children who are about 7 or 6 or 5 or 4 maybe, down to about 4, I guess that's about the lowest limit you can go, maybe from 4 on up to 8, maybe 9 at the outermost limit, there are millions of kids in that age group between 4 and 9 who will be tremendously influenced by this fair. and in ways that any of us adults will not see. It'll be just a big thing. We'll go there. It'll be a show. We'll walk around and look at it, and guys will go to the Futurama, and they'll ride up and down on the people wall, and they'll go and scratch underneath the stainless steel trees and all the rest of it, you know. And they'll walk around and come home and have a beer and watch the Mets on television. And by the middle of next week, it will be forgotten along with millions of other things that happen to an adult. Most adults really don't have much in the way of an imagination, and certainly very little in the way of memory. They hardly remember last week. It is very difficult to get an adult to really remember last year's crisis in the political world. Really is. Have you noticed how quickly we have already forgotten Sonny Liston? He's really dead. I mean, he's really gone. And if one of the saddest things of all is the sudden complete eclipse of Patterson. I was reading an article in one of the magazines by a friend of mine, Gay Talese, today. It was about Floyd Patterson. Obviously, it was written before the Clay Liston fight, and it was like reading something out of let's say medieval Europe. I mean, yeah, it was just completely irrelevant to the world today because suddenly Patterson and his problems are gone. Forget it. It is hard to remember last week's big excitement. And so, but not for a kid, you see. He is now forming original patterns. All adults already have these patterns well established, and they go so far back that it will be impossible in most cases to even break them, much less bring them to the surface. But the kid is forming them. And I wonder how a kid, say 6 or 7 years old, is going to react to riding up and down on the people wall in the IBM. No, how it's going to affect his life. And how walking around under the stainless steel trees and all the rest of this, how he will discuss this 40 years from now. We'll all be gone for the most part. But how a kid will discuss this 40 years from now, what if he remembers anything of it, and most of them will, what will be the connotations he will put on it, because he will have lived to see a lot of the stuff, you know. When they will finally have, the new Robert Moses will have come along and will finally have been able to get rid of, just mow down Central Park completely and replace it with the new U.S. Steel stainless tree. All up and down, you know, and the world will be one gigantic super highway, and of course, the guy of that time will—I'm talking about the man who will remember back when he was 3 and 4 years old, this ancient World's Fair that was held back in those simple, halcyon, innocent days of 1964 and 65. Now, I'll tell you a little exhibit that I remember from the World's Fair when I was a kid that really impressed me tremendously. And I'll bet my father didn't remember 20 minutes after we got out of there. Because he was an adult, you know, he was grown up. Didn't mean anything to him, it was just a thing. He looked at it and went on to the old Heidelberg looking for a hot dog, a knockwurst, and some beer. And that was about it as far as he was concerned. Yeah, he was always hollering, you know, oh, come on, I don't want to walk on, my feet hurt, let's get out of here. Well, of course, I was walking around, my eyeballs as big as saucers, just absolutely gassed by it all. There was a French village. Now, get this. This is at the World's Fair. Now, this was called A Century of Progress. Just like our World's Fair is called, it is a paean to progress. It's a hymn to the great things that we're doing and a kind of giant doily, hem stitched by Robert Moses and the New York Chamber of Commerce to, I can just see, God bless progress. God bless all the big companies, and everything's going to work out great. A gigantic doily. Now, that's literally what it says in a way that it's the best of all possible worlds, and the biggest exhibit makes that the clearest point. Now, I would like to describe to you an exhibit. They had a French village in the World's Fair in Chicago. And I'm this little squirt. I was just a little kid, and I was, of course, the World's Fair was the talk of Chicago. It was an insane thing. Everybody, just like today, you know, everybody's talking about the fair. It's a big topic of conversation. Well, if you lived, I wonder how you would feel if you were a kid about 6, say, or 5 or something like that, and you're living 2 blocks from where they're building the giant World's Fair right now, And you see that world being built there, you know, that big thing, they have the big symbol of the world and all that stuff, and you see these wild buildings, and you hear people talking about Futurama, and people talking about Progress Land, and people talking about it all, you know, the big excitement. The kids are probably hearing it on the air right now, you know. And it is a tremendous thing, much bigger than it would be to you, to an adult, you know, really. And so as a kid, this was being, I remember it was being built not too far from where we were living. And it took years to build it, you see, and that's what added to it. It was a gigantic stage pause, an enormous overture. And the first thing that appeared on the lakefront was a copy, exact copy of Fort Sheridan, which was an old fort, and a fort that was there at the time that Chicago was just a lot of sand dunes and the lake. And the Indians came down to fight down the Chicago River, and they came out of Joliet, and they fought around Fort Sheridan. And they built an exact scale model of Fort Sheridan. Well, of course, we would ride around. We'd see that. We saw that right on the lake there. And they allowed some people to come in and look at it. And I remember going in and seeing this before the fair opened up. And, of course, I was gassed. It's just fantastic. And they had genuine tools and stuff of the pioneers strewn around, and you could see where the arrows had come in and where the guys had shoot out through the little slots in the blockhouses and all that stuff. Well, the fair slowly began to build. The next thing that appeared was about a half a mile from there and not too far from the Adler Planetarium was a genuine Chinese pagoda with a gold leaf roof. The gold leaf was applied by Chinese workmen. It was a beautiful pagoda. It was Chinese red, you know, and had these scalloped roofs, and it stood there in the sun, and you could see the sun bouncing off this golden roof. And, it, you know, of course, everybody was gassed. The word got out immediately that it was genuine gold. And since this was a depression, they had immediately put a guard of about 5,000 guys around it, because every guy on the south side figured if he could get close to that dad, he would be in business for at least 6 months. And, yeah, that's right, there was a talking. Wow, it's real gold on the roof there. And so, one by one, things began to spring up until finally they roped it off, and then the next thing you know, they had a fence up, and you couldn't see anymore. You could just see flags sticking up. And it was a genuine fair. After that, of course, came the turnstiles. But this thing grew until finally you could hardly contain yourself. And they began to publish gigantic issues in the paper about what's going to go happen on the Avenue of Flags, how the Great Mall is going to look and how the people are going to be. Every last detail was discussed. They are less interested today in detail. They would discuss at great length on how the buses would take you from one place to the next, how they happened to name the Skyride Amos and Andy, and how the various cars were named, there was Ruby, there was Madam Queen. These were little cars that went back and forth, high over Grant Park, over the lagoon there. Well, one by one, things began to build up until finally this thing was really swinging. And the day came when they began to let people in. It opened up. The mayor cut the ribbon. The president pressed the button. The horn started to blow. And 18 million people were allowed to come in. And it was just great. It was just incredible. And we started to go to this thing. And we were able to get a book of tickets somehow. The place where my father worked at the time had given out tickets to its employees, and we got free tickets. I remember that. That was a very important issue. And so, one by one, we would attend each one of these exhibits. It spread over the entire lakefront, and we would spend hours in the Hall of Science and hours in the Hall of Transportation that was famous because it had a roof that was not attached to the walls of the building. It was a cantilever suspended roof. And I'd read about that, you know, and as a kid, I go in this giant building, and I'm afraid, you know, wow, this is liable to be the day when it doesn't work. And the roof is going to come down. We walk in there, and my father says, now you see those cables up there? That roof is suspended. And, of course, everybody was amazed at that. But the thing that really got me, now, all that stuff is just plain, ordinary frosting on the cake. The thing that I remember that really belted me right between the eyes and was extremely exciting to me, and which I can see even in my mind's eye right now, I can see it etched as clearly as if it were in a photograph, in a Kodachrome slide in my mind. Do you have, when your memory dredges stuff up, can you see it almost like a Kodachrome slide? You see it there hanging? You see an image? You do, you realize? Is everybody else's memory like, you see a thing there? Do you see high school? Boom. little slide comes up. If I say to you, summertime, boom, a little slide comes up and you see clouds and the lake, you know, and stuff. Do you see that little slides in there? Your mind goes tick, you know, like you're giving a little lecture to yourself. Well, I can see this slide of this French village. Now, let me explain it to you. This World's Fair had, it was a genuine World's Fair. The one we are having now is not. As you know, it has not been approved by the World's Fair Committee, whatever it is in Paris, you know, where they approve of the World's Fair. Are you aware of that? And what that means is that mostly what the exhibits are in the fair that we're going to see are merely big commercial exhibits, big companies like General Motors, and I'm sure PepsiCola and IBM and all these places have exhibits. But a genuine World's Fair does not work like that. The various countries put exhibits of their own in. All the countries will put in an exhibit. It has nothing to do, in general, with commercial things in that country. They merely try to represent their country at the fair. And so, at this World's Fair, they had all these various villages. There was the Turkish village. And they did. They just sent a whole bunch of Turks, and they did. The Turkish people, the Turkish government did, just apparently went over to some little town in Turkey that they figured they could get rid of, that everybody, you know, was pretty mad at anyway. They threw a big net over it, put a big crate around it, put it on a boat, and sent it to Chicago. And then they opened up the crate, and there they were. All these Turks are running around trying to sell rugs and yelling and hollering and chewing and smoking hookahs and stuff. You were in the middle of a Turkish village. I'm telling you, I've been in the Middle East, and believe me, they brought a chunk of them. It even smells like it. They brought all the camel dung and everything. You know, you walk around. Literally, it was there. I'm serious. Absolutely. I'm not being funny. They really reproduced the countries there on the grounds. Then they had a Black Forest village that was right, oh yeah, including 15,000 Nazis sitting, yeah, that's a fact. This was when they were hollering, Oi, Deutschland, Ober Irish, and they had the beer going, and the band, Schick Heil, they were hollering. Well, of course, that added to the color of the scene. And there was a gigantic, believe it or not, there was a gigantic Hitlerian eagle there with a big swastika. And it was all there. Yeah, they brought it all over. and then there were all these different villages of various kinds. And it was funny how just like when you go to Europe, you form an immediate antipathy to various countries. You dig others, you don't like. Like, my mother immediately didn't dig Turkey. As a matter of fact, I immediately did. It's, you know, there was something about the Turks that was skulking around there, and I liked Turkey immediately. You know, there were all kinds of bazaars and stuff, and guys going, bakshish, bakshish, and they were all there. They brought the whole scene over, believe me, was all going. Well, one of the villages that they had was a French village. Now, wait a minute now, before you make an immediate judgment, let me tell you about this French village. They reproduced completely a genuine French village that had been destroyed or had been blasted in World War I. Yeah, here was this French village. It was all blasted. And over on one end of the street, I'll never forget this scene, on one end of the street was a French house. You know, that kind of middle European house that looks like it's made of sort of concrete with a vaguely thatched roof, you know, that kind of little windows. Little sign hanging out in front of the restaurant or something, and you could see the little courtyards and so on. Well, the top of the building was burnt out, and hanging right in the top, get this, was a crashed German Albatross, which was a biplane of World War I. It was a German fighter plane, and it was crashed. It was laying right, boom, you know, it was a crashed German World War I airplane. And it was as though this airplane had been shot down. You could see the machine gun holes and the flak holes in it. And it had been shot down, and it had crashed into this house in the middle of this bombed out French village. And there it was, boom, just like that. And it was laying there, and the tail was sticking up, and they had searchlights on it. And then at night, they would play big searchlights up as though there was an air raid coming over. Yes, literally, it was a destroyed French village of World War I. Well, of course, I walk down there, and I take one look at this, and fantastic, you know, great Scott. And I'm a kid, and at that point, airplanes were extremely exciting to me. And, of course, once in a while, somebody would talk about Daredevil Aces or Lone Eagle or G8 and his Battle Aces. And here was an actual German albatross crashed into the roof of a French building. Well, of course, we're walking through every village. We just took in the fair. We only lived about a mile from there. And we went to everything in the fair indiscriminately. We went to the dairy exhibit. We went to the exhibit of the, you know, of the wheat growing techniques exhibit, and all that. Yo, a lot of boring stuff walking around. So we went to everything. We saw every last corner of the fair. So naturally, we wound up in this place among others, and they had a little French restaurant there, and they had guys walking around in this French village, dressed in World War I French army uniforms. There were French officers and French. French privates and French enlisted men of one grade or another, and they were sitting around at cafes, and there were French girls there. Yes, they had brought over a whole bunch of French girls who were dressed in the World War I, and this was naturally many, many years afterwards, but they were dressed in the World War I French costumes, and they were sitting around in the cafes where the plane had crashed. You could see the lights and all that, and you walk around, and they're saying, oh, yeah, you know, they're talking French, and there are girls hiding in doorways and peeking out, you know, and guys selling you postcards. The whole scene, yeah, literally, right down to the little, absolutely, I'm not kidding you, they did it all. of course, we had an uncle, you see, who I've rarely, rarely discussed. My Uncle Paul. My Uncle Paul was famous as being the uncle who had spent 18,000 years in World War I. And he had been overseas, and he was famous for having been gassed. Well, he was gassed several times in the years that I knew him, but he was he was gassed several ways. But old Uncle Paul went to this thing, and this became a story in the family. He went to this village. Well, the minute he got there, he had been a GI in World War I. The minute he got there, it was like he was back home. He starts hollering that pigeon French that all... Ooh, la, la, oh, man, you know, he rushes into this place, and he sits down at the table, and apparently it took him 3 days to get him out of there. He was really back home, and for days on end after that, every available minute, old Uncle Paul is down there in the French village, looking at the buildings, running around with the French girls, and hollering at the French officers, and they even had French MPs that were arresting him every couple of days. And he went back, and he did everything but get his old uniform on with the tin hat, you know, and the hand grenades hanging on the side, and go down there to sit back there with the old days. I'm sure that many of the guys of the, you know, the American Legion guys must have really wound up at this place. But here is the point I'm making. We in this building that was supposedly destroyed by the albatross, where all these buildings, in one way or another, were kind of exhibits. You could go into these buildings. You could go into the French house. They had an actual, you know, French peasant home, and there was a French meat market and a little French bistro, and all here was a little French sidewalk cafe and one thing. And they were all operating. You could come in, and I guess you could buy yourself a couple of lamb chops if you wanted to there. Yeah, literally. You could go in, because all, in the Turkish village, I know you could buy all kinds of stuff. And they really got mad. The Chicago police, when they found out what you could buy down there, they were in business. So you walk into these various places, and you could do whatever was going on there. Well, in the place where I remember now, yes, it was a little French church. It was one of these little churches, and the plane had crashed into it. And you could see where they had a dummy. It was a dummy that was dressed apparently in an authentic German World War I flying costume, and the dummy was sort of half hanging out of the plane, hanging up. Yeah, right up there in the lights. Well, it was an insane exhibit, and then you went inside to this little building, and they had all around the walls in this building, they had mementos and souvenirs and one thing and another of the World War I battlefields in France. And you could walk around there, and here were pictures on the walls of the Marne and pictures of Chateau Thierry and all that. And there were all kinds of great big scenes. They had movies in there of various battles going on. And it was a whole big thing. And you come there and you walk around and look at all these things. And then you could buy, they had a little booth there. And I bought this because I was interested in airplanes. They had a little booth in the middle of this place where you could buy European model airplanes. They sold little airplanes, and you could buy models of the French Newport, baby Newport 28, the French Spads. You could buy models of the Farman biplanes. You could buy models of the Albatross, the Fokker D7, the D6, the D3, the D8. The Fokker Tripe. You could buy all these different things there. And here was a girl, a French girl, standing around selling these things. And she was wearing a little French, the little French jumper kind of thing there. And she talked a very broken English. And you would come up and you would say to her, "Un spad." "Un spad." And she would say, "Oh, I mean, wait, wait." And she would reach back and give you the spad. And you would try to count out change. And you would walk out with a little model of the Spad, which is what I was able to get because that was the big thing, you know. And going out of this place, I looked around, and here it was. All the lights were playing on it, and they had set right down in the middle of the square of this little town, they had a genuine French anti-aircraft battery with the big, you know, the big carbon arc lamps. The tremendous lamps are going. And every night at a certain time, they would do in a sense they would recreate an alert. You see, all the French soldiers would run up with the little anti-aircraft guns, and they had the big listening things. In those days, of course, it was before radar, and they had these big listening horns like that would revolve. Have you ever seen those sinister looking things in the World War I movies when Erich von Richthofen? Baron von Richthofen and Adolf von Stroheim is saying, "You will mend the bombers." You know this thing, and they had this thing going around, and you see the guy, "Achtung, Achtung, you know, they're hollering always into the phone. This is the kind of thing they had, and they had these big wooden horns moving around, and then there would be an air raid, of course, you see, and they had records playing, and you'd hear. And lights would light up, red lights all around the side of the edges of the buildings, and somewhere you got the impression that a gigantic artillery barrage was beginning over there, somewhere near the Hall of Transportation, just on the other side of the Chinese Peace Pagoda. And you could hear the crump of those 105s and the French 75s, of course. And then once in a while, you could hear the roar of a water-cooled machine gun. And these French guys, who were actors apparently, but all brought over by the French government, would jump up on the platform and start operating the thing. You see, and the lights would go on searching, and everybody would stand in the background, you sort of behind ropes, and watch. It was like watching a war going on, a real war. And the lights are sweeping up and down, sweeping up and down. And they would play on a record again. You could hear the airplane, you see, and they're searching for it. And then they would fire blanks from their their 75, their French 75 anti-aircraft gun. They go, and you'd see the smoke fly and the powder would burn, and these guys are loading the shells. Boy, I'll tell you, and everybody is standing around cheering. Well, we would leave. Of course, this would last for about 20 minutes, and then it would be over. And the guy would be, "The next performance will be in the 25 minutes. 25 minutes, we invite you to visit the genuine Francais." And they would invite you to visit the French bistro now, where drinks are being served by Le Capitaine. And sure enough, the anti-aircraft crew would jump behind the bar and start serving Pousse Café. And they would start serving Pernod, and we would be back to normal. Well, I left this thing, of course. I was a little kid. I was a real tiny kid, and I was really gassed by this. And I'm sure that to most people, and it certainly was to me, this was a very innocent little exhibit. Just, you know, an innocent thing. Oh, no, everyone said, "Oh, boy, no, wow. No, it was very innocent, and I'm sure that the guys will walk into exhibits out at the World's Fair that we are having that look to us perfectly innocent. They look completely innocent to us, but guys, 45 years from now, will say, oh, wow, and I'll tell you what they had. They had this big building. You go in there, and they had the rockets. And there was a satellite was launched, and boy, everybody, so I don't know why, everybody, you know, applauded, and yet they did, and I remember that scene as clearly as if, and it literally is etched in my mind, and I'm sure that World's Fairs quite often say a great deal more about us than the actual exhibits do, literally, than the actual things that we're trying to show. I remember going to... I went to the Brussels World's Fair. I don't know how many of you were there, but I went to the Brussels World's Fair, and I walked around in the various exhibits, and one exhibit really got me. I remember going into an art exhibit that was done by the Russians. It was one of the scariest exhibits on the whole grounds, the art exhibit. And it just had a certain quality of it had nothing whatsoever to do with ideology. That was just, it was scary that this kind of art should be displayed seriously as art. Well, I have a suspicion we're doing it out at our fair. Have you been reading about the art hassles going on out there? And the big-eyed kids that are walking around in the great big hall of education, the big Walter Keane drawing, you know? I have a vague feeling that a lot of that is happening at our fair. And I could see that old plane hanging in there and the lights flashing. My old man said, come on, let's go over to the old Heidelberg, will you? Everybody wanted to go to the old Heidelberg exhibit, by the way, because the German exhibit had a gigantic beer hall there. They had 10-cent beer and 7-cent knockwurst. And guys would sit down there in the middle of the beer, in the middle of the knockwurst, surrounded by guys wearing these flat hats, you know, and the leather pants, the lederhosen, and they're singing just simple little chip, oh, Deutschland over alles, and everyone, you know, just a simple little exhibit, didn't mean much.